KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm sitting across from a man you may know from The Coop or Street Sweepers or whatever else you know him from, but now you know him as a major filmmaker with his directing debut, feature debut. The film is Sorry to Bother You. My guest, of course, is Boots Riley. Thanks for being here, Boots.
Hey, thank you for having me.
My pleasure to have you. And this is the point you get to tell people what the movie's about.
It's an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by the world of telemarketing. It's called Sorry to Bother You.
That's pretty much it.
Lakeith Stanfield plays Cassius Green, who's a black telemarketer with self-esteem issues and existential angst, who discovers a magical way to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by a white actor, who's played by David Cross. Hilarity ensues.
Yes, it does. But one of the things that I mentioned to you when we had your LACMA not too long ago is that what you do in your music and what's happening here is there's a density to your work. And it seemed to catch you off guard when I said that.
Yeah, I mean, there is. And, you know, yeah, it is something that I've been told to not do in all of my work. You know, like, you know, there's a sense that when you put a lot of stuff in, it's just because you don't know what to do and you're just like throwing it all in there. And I don't know if that's, I don't think that's right. It's just there are so many, I want to emulate a feeling that I think gets lost sometimes when we make stuff. So, and especially in black culture, it's been, for me, the ascendance, the sophistication means to get rid of stuff. Like, it's clean. Oh, that's clean. That's smooth. That's, you know, we use those terms like that. And I'm not saying that I don't like things that maybe could be called that or termed that, but I think we miss something about the details of life. So, you know, we've made music that's dense and, you know, purposely sometimes sloppy, you know, like where you feel the drummer, you know, or you feel that bass player getting a little bit more excited on this part or whatever. And I think with music that kind of came out in the time that we were coming out, it was all about getting things streamlined. And that sense of, and maybe it's a sense of like getting away from all of these problems and like having more control because things are sparse and put together. So we've always had all these layers of different things that, and as I went on, I allowed myself to put in, because earlier on I was like editing out things that I didn't think were like hip hop, like, oh, these are things that I like, but there is a genre called hip hop and these things don't fit into it. And I think what I realized is that what was more important is passion. And for me to be more passionate about things, I had to let things in that might not have been, to some closed-minded people, part of hip-hop or even a style or a way that you do things. And so, anyway, all of that I carry into everything that I do.
What you're talking about, though, is for me, is that you're in love with ideas, and the more ideas you can cram into something, the better. Because for me, these things feel lived in, and you walk into a place where it feels like somebody's been there, you see all this stuff around.
Yeah.
It just feels almost automatically like home to you in a way that really clean stuff doesn't. It feels like a showplace rather than a house.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see, then you even more notice like the little thing that the, you know, art director brought in that was cool, the little colorful thing, because it's all clean, like, and there's the one thing there, and it feels, you know, there's something to that. I don't you know, I've seen movies that I like that are like that, but I think it's missing, doing too much of that is missing, you know, that life that, you know, I was going for a beautiful clutter is what, and that's how I sold it to everybody that was coming on board and helping collaborate. You know, is that it was, that there's beauty to be found in all of these things.
And it's almost like found art. Or I find myself thinking, especially when I listen to yourself, of like the Pedro Bell album covers for Parliament Funkadelic. Where there's tons of stuff going on in those pieces. And you just want to take one of those gatefolds and just look at it for hours.
Exactly. I mean, and especially since now people can look at stuff for hours and over and over. And I want people to be getting a lot from it when they're doing that.
I mean, I found myself thinking about movies like, certainly we talked about this, about Brazil, but also Blade Runner. There's a kind of a clutter to that, too.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, it doesn't look like the clean future we're used to in movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what made it feel real all of a sudden. I mean, I think that for certain parts of Star Wars, too, like, you know, like they're going into the trash heap or they're, or maybe even the house that Luke lived in with his aunt and uncle. That was something that I don't think that we had in other stuff. I mean, Zardoz had it a little bit, but it was still, like, really cool. Everything was really cool. And, yeah, so I think Blade Runner definitely had that cluttered feel that made it feel like a real place.
I was even telling you, though, in terms of the costume design that we see when we first see Cassius, he's basically like not really matching. He's got these patterned ties and these patterned shirts, and there's this even clutter in his life and what he puts on to go out into the world.
Yeah, and just shout out to Deirdre Govan, our costume designer. I think what really came, because this was my first film, and I think I'll be like this with all of them, but detail was really important. Like, why am I going to, you know, like, oh, that's just a wall. No, it's not. You know, like, we're going to be seeing it. And this is the film I've been working on for all these years. We're going to figure out what's on that wall. You know, like, there's going to, it's, you know, it's not just a shirt. It's not just, all of these things are what, you know, tools to make people feel something.
It's a treat. We're talking about detail and absurdity with the director or writer of the film. Sorry to bother you, Boots Riley. But I think I just found myself thinking about, because people say the movie's crazy and you said that, but I feel like there's like a strain of absurdism, surrealism that runs in Black culture. Again, you look at Sun Ra or George Clinton or Ralph Ellison or Gail Jones or Toni Morrison. There's a because the fact that living as a Black person in the United States, there is like a level of absurdity that defines our existence, isn't there?
And yes, and definitely, you know, you shouted out a few people from George Clinton to Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison that I thought about consciously, you know, as I was making this, that I felt like there was something about, there was something that was said about life. Maybe we're saying different things about it, but there's something through the details and the just, you know, like in Invisible Man, just the slapping on of life that happens, you know? And I wanted to have that sense.
And there's that sense in Alice Walker and in Ralph Ellison. All these things you're talking about were people who are marginal populations are pitted against each other, which is a big part of this movie, too, isn't it?
Definitely. I think that, and what this film does is, there are many people who, in the film, that we can have sympathy for, or empathy with, and folks that are making decisions that I don't think we, like, wag our finger at them. You know, I have an opinion, basically, because I've been through this life, and we're all going to have an opinion. But the point is that, you know, one, some of the characters I put extreme flaws in, or whatever, or not flaws, contradictions, you know, and because it exists in life, and I wanted that to be there. And so sometimes when we're talking about things, we're talking about the way we think the world should be and all of that, especially nowadays on Twitter, you know, we are approaching everyone as if they're supposed to be perfect. And once we find out they're not, that's over. Like, there's no development. And part of that is because most of us aren't part of some movement that's trying to change the world, right? And the reason that we want to change the world is we know it's not right. We're not like, let's go find another world. Well, we can't. But, you know, we're like trying to change what's here and, you know, hopefully bringing everybody with us. And so our protagonist is somebody that doesn't have it all together, but I don't.
And the title even suggests that somebody who's basically sort of like almost apologizing for his existence in some way.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to go with thinking about that title, and that is definitely one of them. That, you know, he does, you know, at the beginning, he's questioning his existence. And for me, I thought that was important to have, one, in a character, because I think that's just real. But two, I don't know if there are any black films where that's any concern of the character. It's usually like some very mechanical, like, I've got to save my uncle's house, or, you know, we got to save the rec center, you know, or, you know, like, can we have a dance movie where they don't have to save the rec center? And, you know, like, I'm against evil real estate tycoons, but, like, why does dance have to be doing that? You know, like, nobody wants to dance because they love it. You know, it's otherwise there's no excuse for people to be dancing if they're not trying to save the rec center.
Well, that's just it. You know, you got to have a reason to be with the dancing on screen. It's not just for the sheer pleasure of dance, for goodness sakes. Haven't you ever seen a movie before? But that's so interesting, because as you're talking about this, one of the things I realize that makes a movie to me so fascinating, again, this gets back to what you do, is that it's like everybody's trying to figure out who and what they are. I mean, Tessa Thompson plays a character named Detroit, and by the way, I'm from Detroit, so that had a special impact for me. But just bringing that name into this has associations for people. I mean, because first of all, people think one way about Detroit, and it's an entity that demands more explanation.
Yeah.
And just that name is just so plain spoken.
And the reason that she says that she has it, which is that her parents wanted her to have an American name. And all that Detroit's history implies is very wrapped up in what quote-unquote America is.
So I hear. But, I mean, that's one of the things I think is so much fun about the movie for, I think, everybody who's seen it and really loves, is that it's a movie that really demands to be seen more than once. And that was part of your design, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one, it's a good marketing plan. You know, you have to, you know, get like triple the money. But yeah, I don't want this to be I didn't want to make a movie about the one thing, you know. And that's a lot of notes I got from friends that were well-meaning and were like, I'm a writer and this is what you should be doing. Like, you know, like his white voice should be the thing that saves him at the end, right?
Somebody told you that?
Because that's how you're supposed to do it, right?
Okay.
And it should be just about this one, you know, that sort of thing. And it was like, yeah, sort of, you know, it would have changed the whole meaning of it all. But the point that I'm saying is that those are the problems you come at when you're trying to make it about the one thing, that you have to stretch it out for 80 minutes. And you end up taking license. I mean, obviously, this isn't not real life, but I feel like I was trying to get at more of the things we believe and the things we think about and all of those things than what happens when you have that simple problem that then, you know, seems to get solved, but then doesn't, and then it does, you know, and you know, it gets boring, but you have if you did it that way, you have some cool dialogue, you could throw in some stuff that looks good, and people will accept it because it's happening.
Right. It's also the idea that people have to be saved, which is not what this movie's about. We'll take a break. We're talking about what tips not to listen to with the writer-director. Sorry to bother you. Of course, it's Boots Riley. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. Don't give my guest Boots Riley any tips. He won't listen to you. His first film as writer-director is Sorry to Bother You, which, again, there's so much to talk about here because it was hard getting off stage with you last week when we were talking just because there's so much going on in the movie. I got to imagine that people come up to you and everybody's telling you something about the movie you didn't see.
Yeah, yeah. And or some things that I did think about at the time but forgot.
Well, like I mentioned to you, for me, there's a visual correlative of so many people are in these pens and or these really confined spaces that suggest stables. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a really big motif throughout the film, and mm-hmm. you were saying that wasn't something you were doing consciously, right?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I was trying to represent some of the claustrophobic ways that these things could feel, even when they're expansive. You know, like I feel like we got kind of a, you know, when we show the telemarketing floor and with the
shout out to our yes.
amazing production designer Jason Kisvarde. We originally wanted to do the forced perspective, steal from the apartment. I don't mind stealing from things as long as I'm stealing from a lot of things and slapping them on top of each other because I know that's what those filmmakers did. And that would have, with the way we were shooting it, it would have like locked us into one direction. And anyway, but the point is that I think we got away with making us see that there was space while still feeling confined and locked into these things. You know, everybody's in their box, their cubicle. It's not a new notion, but I think we, you know, did something visual there that comes off.
Well, you do. And I thought the reason I brought that up was because I thought that it really does sort of make us subconsciously think about the way animals are penned up. Mm. And that becomes a really big part of the film later on. I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I was saying to you, too, that struck me about this and runs through a lot of the songs as well is this idea of losing who you are. You know, this idea of losing your essential self and the fear of that, which seemed to catch you off guard when I mentioned that, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I'm also saying, though, is that so much of what we do is a performance. And how do we find our essential self in the first place? How do we know that what that is? You know what I'm saying? Like from, you know, he has a picture that he looks at a lot. And we, you know, I think that's part of him thinking about who he is or who he was. And it's probably somebody from his past, but I think it's all connected. Like we talk about the white voice in the sense that there is no real white voice, that even that is a performance for white people, you know, and that it's a perform in this.
Well,
case,
Danny Glover's character talks about how that performance is offering all this subtext. You hear this voice, and you thirst, and you say it this way, people will think this way about you.
Yeah.
And that idea of acting in your real life becomes part of all this.
Yeah, and so it's, I think it's really about that. So the idea of losing one's essential self is similar to the idea of trying to find one's essential self, you know? And I don't think it's something we're supposed to find.
Really? Because again, I just, that fear of not being able to connect with who and what you really are and get your message across.
Yeah.
It's something that runs so much, I mean, sort of in subtextual terms, also in conscious terms in your music.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing is that who we are is so fluid. You know, I think about it like this. Like, many people think Teddy Pendergrass is the pinnacle of black music, right? That's blackness, right?
Okay.
Listen to George Clinton in 1977 talking about how all that Sound of Philadelphia stuff is just white pop music from the 50s.
And again, he would know because we talked about this. He got to start doing doo-wop and doing that kind of thing, then breaking away from that, realizing that wasn't who he was or what he wanted to be.
And how Parliament Funkadelic is also blackness, right? But he was in that same interview complaining about how up until they had that hit, people called their music white music. You know, and so the essential self, I think there's a truth, there's a principle that you want to abide by. You want to figure out what your principles are, what you stand for in life, you know, all those things. But the form that comes in, sometimes when we're talking about ourselves, we're really talking about other things that aren't ourselves. So, like, does that mean that Teddy Pendergrass is not blackness? He is, because that's what we experienced, you know?
But it's almost getting back to that thing that we start the interview talking about, the idea of that kind of smoothness and that clean versus clutter.
And I my other thing against Sound of Philadelphia, like Questlove probably wouldn't like me saying this, is that it was apologizing for the system. It was saying, look, we don't need the civil rights movement. We got it. Ain't no stopping us. And ain't no stopping us meant just we could buy a car or something like that.
Or dance.
You know? Yeah, I mean, dancing is, that's, you know, I won't put that in the same category. But it was like with this thing, you know, like everybody was like wanting to be the people in the Emerald City and the Wiz, you know? And that's what that music represents. That's why they had all the strings. Like, we could have an orchestra, you know? Like, speaking of Detroit, there's Junie Morrison, who was in Parliament Funkadelic and in
Ohio
Players. He had his own solo album. And, you know, the first thing he says on the song that's coming out there, he's like, you know, I got the Detroit Symphony behind me, right? And, you know, there's this idea of luxuriousness that basically said we don't need that dirty you know, like, it's clean, we got the orchestra and stuff like that. I mean, somebody who maybe did both without saying that maybe was like Curtis Mayfield, but in some songs. But yeah, there's this sense of, you know, we're in now, stop all that, you know, movement nonsense. And you know, at the most, we want to have a movement where we, you know, say we tell each other to stop hurting each other or something like that, which was a, you know, anyway, it's a myth that.
Well, my guest who's telling us to get off the love train and not turn off the lights is the writer director. Sorry to bother you. Boots Riley. See what I did there? My guest
brought it all.
Hey, just, you know, doing what we call in the radio business a segue.
Yeah.
But see, this is what I'm talking about. And this is what makes your work so interesting as a musician and as a filmmaker, as a visual artist and an oral artist, is this idea of being able to have conflict. I mean, it's essentially drama. You're putting two things against each other and not offering, telling, or not making explicitly a judgment about it. Because, you know, what we see with Cassius, he's trying to figure out who he is. You know, he wants to be a baller. And they're hearing white guys tell him he should be a baller or asking questions about why they're saying that to him and why they're selling him on this. There's this constant idea of what you should be listening to amidst all this clutter, both visually and sonically, is fascinating to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what gets me going is the contradiction, is the you know, because that's what analysis is, right? Analysis is here's the contradiction. Like, I don't have to then go further and say a judgment, because I think that if I show you the contradiction and I show what happens as a result of the contradiction, I'm laying it all out there for you, you know. And that contradiction also, though, that analysis and that contradiction inside it is very closely related to irony. And irony is a, you know, a good part of comedy, you know. And so many of these things, you know, a lot of the effective organizers I came up around that were much older than me, they were effective because they weren't from this aesthetic of I'm the rebel and, you know, like blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm more, you know, this than you or whatever.
I'm better than you. In
you know, or whatever. Or like, I've got the truth. They were people that were good at talking to people and good at hanging out with people and good at, you know, making jokes and things like that. So they were always talking about things and they were funny people that people wanted to be around because, you know, they're people persons or whatever. And that's,
people?
That's, yeah, people. And so, you know, I didn't have this idea that talking about the way the world is, even though it's f***ed up, meant being angry. You know, it meant looking at things clearly. And humor is part of that.
But also, too, this idea of him, for me, just trying to take his measure against everybody. And when he's with Detroit or when he's with anybody else, mm-hmm. he's trying to be that person. And there's sometimes it's easier because he's closer to these people.
Yeah.
And that struggle, that conflict is as much what the movie's about as anything else.
I think there's a big conflict between him and Detroit and that pushes him along in this and that that's part of measuring himself up to everyone. And I think that, I don't know, I just think that's real. I think that's how a lot of people are, or at least I assume they are. And hopefully, you know, they can push past that. But yeah, we think about ourselves in terms of what other people have done and what other people are doing. And, you know, how do we fit in the scheme of things? And part of his whole existentialist crisis has to do with himself in the context of, and I mean, that's part of what it is, yourself in the context of time, yourself in the context of history, and, you know, in the context of humanity.
But all this, too, you're mindful of the fact that the movie is still, first and foremost, a comedy.
I don't see any conflict in that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, I think so many movies edit, similar to what I did early on in my career, you edit things out with the idea that this won't be seen as this genre, this won't be seen as that. And then I could see how after a while you get used to writing things in a certain way. So then when you try to add them back in, it's mechanical and doesn't work. I think that's the way that I just think about the world, is that and the way that I talk about things have to do with those little pieces of irony that if you put them there just out front, they're hilarious, you know, and sad and, you know, and unnerving.
I wish we weren't out of time, but we are. You have to come back, please. You're welcome here anytime.
Okay, cool. I'll be talking a lot.
Oh, I'll be listening a lot.
All right.
My guest, who's full of contradictions, but so is his movie, is, of course, Boots Riley. He's the writing director. His feature film debut is terrific, by the way. It's Sorry to Bother You. Thanks again for doing this, Boots.
Thank you for having me, really.
My pleasure. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLacula. The show is mixed by Kat Yore, is edited by Blake Vice, associate producer. I have no contradictions. It's all on the surface here. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.